Welcome to Songcraft, Spotlight on Songwriters. I'm Paul Duncan.
And I'm Scott B. Bomar. To make sure you don't miss an episode of Songcraft, please take a moment right now to subscribe to our show via Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also hear streaming episodes on Spotify. To receive a bi-weekly email with new episode announcements, sign up for our email list at songcraftshow.com.
You can also keep up with us via Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram by searching for one word, Songcraft Show. To find out more about how you can help support our mission while getting access to bonus content, exclusive contests, and other extras, visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/songcraftshow.
You're listening to Grammy Song of the Year winner Sunny Came Home, which was written and recorded by our guest on this episode of Songcraft, Sean Colvin. The 10-time Grammy nominee and 3-time winner will join us in a few moments to discuss her critically acclaimed 3-decade career as an influential singer-songwriter.
Part 1.
So, last weekend there was this thing going around on Twitter. I don't know if you saw this. It was called Ruin a Band with an Extra Letter.
No.
So, the idea is that you take a band that, or even a performer, and just add one letter to the name, and then that one letter destroys the name. So, for example, Spine Doctors.
That's pretty good.
Right? So this guy who posted the original thing, he came up with a few, and then, of course, people started chiming in. And
yeah, Twitter's good for that.
Apparently that's a thing you do on Twitter.
You chime in.
But there was some of these are really funny. So I just thought I'd share a few.
Yeah, please. Especially if they're funny. If they're not funny, I'd rather you not.
But. Well, I hope I have a good sense of your sense of humor. LOL Cool J. Metallicat.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Mean at Work. Bon Jovi. Oreo Speedwagon.
Oh, dude, I went in on this.
Gladys Knight and the Pimps.
I bet there's people that think that's exactly what they're called.
Bald Company.
Oh, that's that's amazing.
I like this one. The Whom.
And the Guess Whom.
There's so many. Ninja Simone.
Oh, God, that's amazing.
Chick Cornea. Nine Inch Snails.
These are too good.
Hair Supply. I'm childish, so I particularly liked Farts Domino.
That might be my favorite one so far.
And you could do some interesting things with one-name artists. String.
Oh, String, yeah.
And Becky.
Oh, Becky. That's solid.
And then I liked for Coldplay, Could Play.
That's deep. That had to come from another Twitter user. Somebody took some time to think of that. Right.
Nice Cube. I mean, there's so many good ones.
I think I just thought of one.
Yeah.
Blob Seeger. That's pretty good, right?
Blob Dylan. You do a whole thing there. Blob Geldof.
What about the Food Fighters?
That's good.
How about the Beagles?
Well, but that's changing a letter.
No, it's not. The Eagles. I just put a letter.
Oh, I thought you meant the Beatles.
No, yeah. The Beagles.
Yeah, the Beagles. That's great. That's perfect.
don't you tell me that I don't know the rules to this game I just heard about 10 seconds ago.
You know, with the keto diet being so popular, I think Death Carb for Cutie could be a, could be a popular band.
Good. My Chemical Bromance.
Jefferson Hairplane.
That's solid. Yeah.
I liked Now Doubt.
Now Doubt.
Now it's safe to doubt.
Van Halen.
Yeah. One guy, he wrote Creamy instead of Cream. that really does ruin it.
Totally.
Wow. No, but Tom Man. Pretty, Irony Maiden. I mean, there's no...
Tom Pretty.
It's the kind of thing of once you start thinking about this stuff, then you can't not think about it.
Wow.
Yeah, I also liked Pelt Shop Boys.
This is one of those things that I don't want to stop doing. Like, I,
yeah, you're gonna lay in bed tonight.
I just want to leave the session rolling and have us just talk for an hour and do this.
You will text me 5 to 10 times before this day is over.
100% is gonna happen.
But anyway, you know, we like to have some fun.
We like to have a little fun around here on Songcraft. Yeah.
So I thought you'd enjoy that. So speaking of having fun,
Stevie Wonder.
The Wu Tango Clan.
Yeah, sorry. Okay, yeah. What you were saying?
Huey Lewis and the Newts. So last time we were talking about Pearl Snap Studios, who you know, we work closely with here at Songcraft, and we are giving away a Pearl Snap Studios baseball cap.
Yeah, or a hate.
Baseball hate.
A baseball cape.
Now it just applies to everything.
Yeah.
So wanted to take a moment and announce the winner. Just as a reminder, we've got a new website, and we had said, hey, go to our new website, check it out, send us a message via the contact form, and we will draw a winner for the Pearl Snap hat. So without further ado, Paul, I'm going to I've got these little note cards here that I've prepared with the names of our winners. So if you want to just kind of grab one there at random.
Now I'll get back to you and you look at it.
All right. Is this the card you chose? It's a magic trick.
It was in my hand.
All right. So the winner that you have chosen here is Randy Nix.
Randy Nix. So
congratulations.
You're the winner of a Pearl Snap cape.
Randy Nix. Pearl Snap cape or hate or or maybe a hat.
It's going to look amazing on you.
So Randy, we'll get in touch with you, get your address, and get that hat off to you ASAP. And while we're on the subject of our new website, I just wanted to mention we've gotten several nice messages from people about the site and about the podcast in general.
Yeah.
We got one from Jane Marr. Jane, I hope you don't mind us saying your whole name on the on the podcast, but
address.
Yeah, right. Social security number. Jane says, I have so enjoyed your podcast. Thank you for sharing stories about the mystery of songwriting. Fascinated with everyone you interview. Thanks. Oh, that's pretty
thank you.
That's the kind of thing that'll, you know, brighten up your day, right? Yeah. That was pretty cool. One guy wrote and he said, I want to hear more direct questions about their processes on writing lyrics, melody, and arrangements. So that person maybe should start their own podcast. But we do appreciate the
listener mail.
We do appreciate the feedback. A lot of cool messages from people.
We will try to stay away from the indirect questions we've been asking so far, just hedging around
where the guests do not know what to say because there wasn't any actual question there, right?
But no. we do appreciate these messages, these emails. Keep them coming. We are starved for affirmation.
Yeah.
So the more you give us,
we crave your, so before we move on to this very cool interview with, Sean Colvin, I thought I'd just share one more message. We received a message from a guy named Blake. He did not give us his last name, but Blake says, guys, absolutely love the podcast and have listened to nearly every episode. One thing I have not come across yet on the show is any book recommendations for those trying to strengthen their songwriting capabilities, improving lyrics, melody, structure, etc. I'm sure you and your guests have read a few that you would recommend. Would love to hear your thoughts. Thanks for making the podcast and keep up the good work. So that kind of got me thinking, you know, a lot of the folks who listen to this podcast probably are developing songwriters.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I didn't have a great answer off the top of my head about some resources, but I know that there are some out there. I know that there's one that was written by a previous guest, and we're actually going to be giving that book away on a future episode.
Yep.
Thanks to Blake kind of reminding us about that. But I bet there's a bunch. So I thought, hey, you know what? Let's take Blake's question here about good books that people would recommend, and let's listener source this. So let's help Blake get a great answer to this question. I bet there's plenty of listeners who have some recommendations. I'm sure a lot of you guys have read books about songwriting and the craft of writing, and maybe there's some you think really stand out. So if that's the case, go to songcraftshow.com.
But just for what is a book?
That's how people used to get information before the interwebs was invented. Mm. So, yeah, yeah.
Sounds heavy.
Yeah, it can be. It can be. But they have something called an ebook.
Ah, now I'm interested.
Yeah, yeah.
Where a you screen? Can I look at a screen?
You can look at a screen because I know you don't get a chance to do that very often. And then you can just read it on the bus. You know, if you're on the bus.
Yeah.
In line at Subway waiting to order your sandwich.
While I'm driving.
While you're driving.
Yeah.
Especially on the freeway.
Sounds amazing.
But anyway, go to songcraftshow.com. Go to the contact form if you've got recommendations for Blake and our other listeners on some good resources. And we'll talk about those on an upcoming episode, as well as give away this book by one of our previous Songcraft guests all about songwriting. So stay tuned for that. And any other news or events we need to touch on before we move on here, Paul?
You know, nothing I can think of, but I'll check my almanac.
I can see, well, that's a book. So that answers your question that you were asking before. I can see from your face that you're just thinking about adding letters to band names over there.
That's the only thing I'm thinking about now.
So without further ado, I think it's time to get to this fantastic interview with a very cool songwriter, Sean Colvin.
Fleetwood Mace.
Part 2.
With 13 albums, a successful memoir, 10 Grammy nominations, and 3 Grammy wins to her credit, Sean Colvin has carved out a unique space as an enduring musical storyteller. Created in close collaboration with producer John Leventhal, her debut album Steady On earned buzz for standout songs such as Diamond in the Rough and Shotgun Down the Avalanche, leading to a Grammy win for Best Contemporary Folk Album. She continued her chart success with subsequent singles such as Round of Blues and I Don't Know Why before releasing her breakthrough 4th album, another collaboration with Leventhal called A Few Small Repairs. The massive hit single, Sunny Came Home, reached number 1 on multiple Billboard charts and won Grammy Awards for Record of the Year and Song of the Year. Thanks to the success of Sunny Came Home, You and the Mona Lisa, and Nothing on Me, A Few Small Repairs was certified platinum and remains a classic of the era. Colvin went on to release a string of critically acclaimed albums, including Whole New You, These Four Walls, and the Buddy Miller-produced All Fall Down. She later reunited with Miller for a duet album with Steve Earle called Colvin and Earle. In 2016, Bonnie Raitt presented Sean with the Lifetime Achievement Trailblazer Award at the Americana Music Awards. 3 years later, she was inducted into the Austin City Limits Hall of Fame alongside legendary artists Lyle Lovett and Buddy Guy. To commemorate the 30th anniversary of her landmark debut album Steady On, Sean recently released an all-new acoustic version of the album, featuring stripped-down versions of her now legendary songs. Sean, welcome to Songcraft.
Thank you so much.
Tell us a bit about where you grew up and what you remember about the first music that really caught your ear and made you think, you know, maybe I'd like to create music of my own one day.
Well, I come from South Dakota, Vermilion, South Dakota. I lived there till I was 11 years old. And it was probably church music, you know, that I heard first. Now, as to what made, it was probably my father's Kingston Trio record collection that caught my ear in terms of what I related to, the, you know, wanting to play the guitar. He played the guitar.
Yeah.
He loved the Kingston Trio like I loved the Beatles, you know.
Hmm.
He revered them. He had, you know, short sleeve striped shirts and friends that would come over and play, you know, banjo and guitar with him. And
right.
I listened to those records a lot.
You and I are similar in that. My dad, I always said that my dad could play the first 3 chords of Scotch and Soda better than anybody. You know, the rest of the song kind of fell apart. But, yeah. I understand that you started playing gigs when you were a student at Southern Illinois University and doing mostly cover songs. Now, how does that begin to shape, you know, your instincts as a songwriter and music creator when you may be playing other people's songs, but you're beginning to see what an audience responds to?
I was younger than a student. First of all, I was a student at SIU for a little over a year, and then I was making money playing music, so why stay in school? But I got gigs before I was even a student.
Oh, wow.
While I was still in high school, not at bars, but at places around the university. So, in that kind of atmosphere, in terms of, you know, clubs and bars, you know, you want to play what they know. Although eventually when I started playing gigs in New York City where nobody listened, I got a lot more experimental with my covers because it didn't matter, you know. I didn't have to please the crowd. They weren't going to hear me anyway. I just, for me, you know, I think there are songwriters that it's like, and I'm quoting James Taylor when I say this, he referred to himself as having sprung out of the wild, and he referred to Joni Mitchell that way as well. I just listened to his audio book, and, you know, by the time he was 20, he'd written half the songs that you hear on his first record. That wasn't the case with me. I was, I learned a lot from all those covers. I had to do years and years of learning and copying, and I was a student, you know, of songwriting before I ever got it together to write them myself.
Well, you know, though you're a fabulous songwriter now, you've never been shy about putting your own spin on other writers' songs. You know, you've released a couple albums of cover material. The last track on your 2015 album, Uncovered, is Larry Henley and Red Lane's Till I Get It Right, which was popularized by Tammy Wynette. And I understand that you were in country bands early on, and I definitely hear plenty of steel guitar and other hints of it in some of your stuff, but in what ways was country music an influence on you as you were developing into a songwriter?
I never really thought about that, because my heroes, you know, I just mentioned Joni and James, and, you know, aside from the Beatles, I guess I said, you know, it was folk music. Kingston Trio, obviously, and, you know, early on, Judy Collins, Joan Baez, and then, you know, the big songwriter, singer-songwriter boom, you know, in the late 60s and early 70s. And so my foray into country music was almost accidental, and it occurred when I was still in Illinois, and I wanted to get out of Carbondale, Illinois, and I joined a country music band that was moving to Austin, Texas, and they were called the Dixie Diesels, and I joined up as the girl singer, because that's the way it worked, and my boyfriend was in the band as well, so it was kind of, you know, fall in love and get out of town join a country band, country swing band. And I learned to sing a lot of classic country tunes, a lot of Patsy Cline, some Tammy Wynette, although she's like the queen, you know, to me. Didn't really go there too much. And I, you know, Merle Haggard. I just learned great classic country music, not to mention country swing, and getting schooled in, like, you know, Bob Wills and the Texas Playboys and Johnny Gimble, and then all the characters down here in Austin, where I live, where I moved back here. All the songwriters here, you know, Joe Ely and Butch Hancock and Willis Allen Ramsey and Guy Clark and Towns, and they kind of, you know, leaned towards the, and still do, some of them lean towards the country side of things, you know, and storytellers, you know, in the Southwest and in the South. And so that was an education, and I think I don't know how it influenced me particularly, except that it's its own genre of, I don't know how to say this without sounding condescending, but it's, there's a simplicity to it, you know? In that classic stuff. It's kind of an in-your-face story most of the time.
Right.
And the music isn't, you know, complicated very often, although sometimes with the Western swing stuff it got pretty wacky.
Right.
So, yeah, Till I Get It Right is just a great example of that. I mean, it's just a poignant, simple, great song. And then with Tammy doing it, you know, how can you go wrong?
Right, right. Well, speaking of country music, after spending time in Austin and the Bay Area, I understand you landed in New York. And I've read that you were in Buddy Miller's band at the time. Is that right?
Yes, it's true. And I met Buddy here in Austin in 1976. He lived here. And he played the drums sometimes back then, too. If you know who Buddy Miller is, he could play anything. It's crazy. But yeah, and then I moved away from Austin. So did he. And we kind of lost touch a little bit. And then in mid-1980, when I had moved to the Bay Area for about a minute and a half, he called, and you know, it was urban cowboy time,
right?
You know, and he had moved to New York City to do country music and sort of like, you know, jump on the ride the coattails of this movement, you know,
sure,
that was kind of championing for want of a better word, country music in Hollywood, or you know. And the girl singer, who is now Buddy's wife, Julie, left New York. She didn't like it. And he needed a girl singer. So he called me, and I moved to New York in late 1980.
Wow. Now, I read online, I'm not sure if this is true, but
everything online is true.
I read that you were in the production of Pump Boys and Dinettes. Is that correct?
That is very true.
Wow. So yes. We've had Jim Lauderdale on the show, and he was in that show. Were you guys in it at the same time?
No, we weren't. I was in a road show production with Maria Muldaur and Tom Chapin. And I don't know which incarnation or which, you know, what Jim was in, but the writers of Pump Boys and Dinettes, the creators of Pump Boys and Dinettes, followed up that musical with another called Diamond Studs about Jesse James. And it never really got legs, but they put it together. I was in it. Jim was in it. Jim was Jesse James. I was his wife, Z James. And we kind of like developed it in Cleveland, Ohio. And it was called Diamond Studs, and we did a run of shows there, but it never took off.
Wow. Yeah, well, that's interesting. We were just talking earlier today about, you know, I think for a lot of songwriters, they think, oh, if I can just get the opportunity to write a song with so-and-so or get in with so-and-so, and it's usually somebody who's already well-known or already established, but the reality is it seems like when you trace people's histories back, there winds up being these connections among different writers or artists, and they're connections from like before anybody really made it. And it's like when someone is developing, it's more important to be paying attention and investing in the relationships with your peers, you know, rather than trying to chase something that's out there. Because those are the people that kind of wind up coming back around, you know, into your life. You know, it's like the talent kind of rises together in a way.
Well, that's the way it worked out for me, and I don't have any memories of going, oh, if only I could meet this one or work with that one.
Yeah.
We were just felt good, you know. We were happy to be working. Period.
Right. Yeah.
And yeah, it was a scene, you know. I mean, we sang in each other's groups. It wasn't just you have your group and I have my group, and everybody sat in with everybody. I was a member of at least two or three bands. Plus, I would do solo stuff. And Buddy left New York City, and that's how I met John Leventhal, because I took over the band, and I needed a guitar player. And our bass player, Lincoln, said, well, let's bring this guy Leventhal over. And I remember the very afternoon that we all got together in the Bronx at Lincoln's place to rehearse, and that's when I met John Leventhal. So, you know, John and I, Buddy, Larry Campbell was in the band, and just, you know, yeah, it was a whole community, a big community. musicians that a lot of whom have done quite well.
Yeah.
Well, and now we know, looking back, that John became a producer and long-term co-writer with you, a collaborator in a million ways. When did you kind of know this is my guy?
In terms of co-writing and
yes.
production? And well, like that afternoon. we caught into each other's musical tastes and musical leanings like immediately. He played the guitar, and I'm like, I didn't know he could write songs. Mm. I didn't, and I just loved the way he played guitar.
Yeah.
He just, you know, was moved by what I did. Mm. Then I came to find that he was at least a music writer. And he would have people write lyrics, and he was writing for a pop band called Mr. B, and they were Steely Dan wannabes.
Mm.
And John was writing this great music, and he started giving me tracks. He's, you know, so to write lyrics to, and I wrote some terrible lyrics. I really have to give him a lot of. You know, when I lived in the Bay Area and when I was younger, I would toy around with stuff. I would write some lyrics. I would put together some tunes. They were pretty, pretty immature stuff and pretty derivative. But that was a very important time when he started giving me music and I was writing lyrics, even though we were trying to write pop songs, and I eventually realized that was a bad move.
Yeah.
But I love pop music, you know.
Yeah.
I love Steely Dan, and I love all kinds of pop music, so it was exciting.
Yeah.
It just wasn't right for me.
Well, in 1989, Columbia Records released your debut album, Steady On, and the title track hit both the Billboard Adult Contemporary and Alternative Songs chart. Take us through how you signed to a major label for your very first record.
Well, I waited. I think I could have made a record before then, but I was trying to invent myself as a cover artist, and it wasn't satisfying. And I was trying to pick a genre, and you know, you remember the kind of the rockabilly thing that was going on with
sure.
Nick Lowe and Dave Edmonds. And,
yeah.
So I kind of went that route for a while. I thought maybe that I should be, you know, the girl that does that. What else did I think of? But really, I needed to write songs, and I wasn't. So when I met John and we started doing these pop tunes, we put a band together. And that was as close as I was getting to kind of finding who I was. But I'm trying to remember what happened with that and why. Your question was what led me to be signed by a major label for
yeah.
my first record.
Yeah.
And really part of it is that I just waited. I waited till I knew I was doing the right thing.
Hmm.
And that came about sort of in a very pointed moment where I got a track of John's that was fully produced, and it was a nice, you know, kind of pop roots tune. And I realized, you know, if I'm an acoustic guitar player, singer, songwriter, solo performer, like that's what I do well.
Yeah.
And if I don't deconstruct this produced piece into a solo acoustic, piece of music, then, well, I just need to do that. You know, that's what I need to do. I have to do that. So, and I never had before. So the track was Diamond in the Rough. Of course, it wasn't called that. but it became that after I made it into this sort of, I tuned the E strings down to D and made this kind of droney, Richard Thompson-y thing happen.
Yeah.
And I wrote Diamond in the Rough. And again, I wrote, I don't know, the first four lines, and they were personal, and I'd never done that before either, except when I was 15. You know, I wrote all these love songs. But,
right.
And I called John, and I said, here are these words that I wrote. As a little girl, I came down to the water. I'm like, is that really twee? I mean, and he said, you know, because I didn't know. And it just popped out of my mouth, and that was unusual, too. I was usually trying to be clever and overthinking everything. And he said, you've got something. Keep going. Now, if he hadn't said that, I don't know if I would have. I don't know if I would have kept going,
yeah.
But I did. So that was the springboard, Diamond in the Rough. And I had found, for want of a better word, you know, a formula. And the pieces of music that I'd had prior to that from him, and then from that point onward, it was important to me to be able to play them by myself and to figure out how I was going to do them on an acoustic guitar. And then I started writing personal lyrics, you know, telling my story and being real honest, and it worked. So then we had a pile of songs after, I don't know, a year or so, and made a demo and got signed.
Wow.
You know, it's interesting that you refer to that, you know, process of sort of needing to find the solo acoustic center of the song, you know, that connection point. Last year, you released a 30th anniversary edition of the Steady On album, and you did. You played every song acoustic, you know, Shotgun Down the Avalanche, you know, Diamond in the Rough, all those songs.
You're shining, I can see.
Was that kind of like a full circle process for you, saying, hey, I've made these records, and yes, we've put production on them and stuff, but this is who I am, and this is what these songs are?
Well, it seemed like a natural way to celebrate the 30th anniversary of that record, of Steady On, because of the reasons I just mentioned, that I turned a corner when I wrote... I became a songwriter. Those are the songs, you know, those are the songs that on that record that I felt like, okay, now I am a songwriter. I'm doing it right. You know, I've found my thing, you know, I've found my voice. And for the past 30 years, for the most part, you know, by and large, if you go hear me in concert, I'm going to be playing alone. So that's the way those songs have been played for the most part. Live all this time, so it seemed like a good way to tip my hat, you know, to that record, to re-record it that way instead of just reissuing it, you know.
Sure. Right. I saw you play it at 328 Performance Hall in Nashville, which is no longer there. Back in
I remember that.
Yeah, it's probably about 96, I think it was.
Yeah.
And it was the first time I'd seen you live, and I, you know, I had your first two records, I know, and you came out and you played acoustic. And at first I was like, wait, is she going to play acoustic? Like, where's the band, you know? And I was kind of like, I was a little bummed at first. But then I was totally, you know, one song in, just won over by your performance style and the interplay of your voice and guitar. And I think that you've really carved out a cool niche for yourself, you know, just playing solo acoustic. You mentioned kind of the drop D tuning on Diamond in the Rough, but do you use a lot of non-traditional guitar tunings and voicings to kind of broaden the sound? Because to me, your acoustic performances sound really full to my ear.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I use a few, you know, not a whole bunch. The G tuning with a drop C in the bass is a favorite. And I just wrote a new song where I kind of made up a tuning because the G tuning with the drop C is getting to be almost my main my main tuning, you know.
Right.
Yeah. So I have to start messing around with other stuff. But yeah, you know, and also Joni Mitchell, you know, how were you going to play that stuff? You couldn't. So such an influence she is on me and was, and I love the sound of those deep, you know, ringing out chords with the deep bass notes, you know, that, that comes with open tuning. I just love it. And also, when you're playing to people that don't listen, you know, it really helps to sound like you're more than one person.
Right.
You know? So the tuning's helped with that too, and I have this sort of percussive style of guitar playing, when, like, Diamond in the Rough's a good example of how I do that. And I developed that sort of in those rooms where nobody listened to make it sound like maybe there was a percussionist. Yeah.
That's interesting. Well, the lead track from your second album, Fat City, is Polaroids, which is one of my favorites.
Please no more therapy. Mother, take care of me. Piece me together.
What can you tell us about that song?
That's one of my favorites, too. I think it's a really good song, and I wrote it by myself, which I have a certain amount of, you know, pride about. Not that there's anything wrong with being a co-writer, but what can I tell you about it? It kind of took on, it had a mind of its own. I started it literally, I mean, the first line is, please no more therapy, right?
Right.
Mother, take care of me. Well, I was on the First Avenue bus uptown to 34th Street to go to therapy. And I had just come off a relationship that was like, you know, didn't work out. And I was just, I'd had it, you know. And I didn't want to go to therapy and talk about it. And I just wanted to be, you know, I just wanted to go home.
Right.
Let my mother fix everything. And then it just... there's something about the rhythm of it, and it just kind of lopes along, and the words just, it became this travelogue of having gone to Europe when I was hired as a backup singer with Suzanne Vega, and then, and where this romance that didn't work out, you know, began, coming back to New York, it was like stream of consciousness, and it really wasn't hard. And the only thing about Polaroids that was hard was I didn't know how to end it, because I could have gone on and on.
Yeah.
It was fun, and that isn't usually the case when I write songs. So I'm trying to figure out how to end it. And I wake up one morning, and I've had this dream, and that's how the song ends. The last verse is, I had a dream last night. And the whole thing with the lovers walking the plank off the ship, and the guy holding up the card that says Valentine. I mean, it was a gift.
Yeah, that's great.
Given to me. Yeah.
This is why those songwriter expo workshops are so difficult. You know, you'll ask a respected writer, well, how, you know, what do you do when you're reaching for inspiration? You say, I just dream it. just go to bed. You'll dream the last verse. Don't worry about it.
I wish it was that. Worked out that time.
Well, you know, we touched on this a bit before, but, you know, your first album had featured only songs that you'd written solo or in collaboration with John Leventhal, but Fat City featured some additional co-writers, you know, Ellie Brown on Set the Prairie on Fire, and Larry Klein from Orion in the Sky, and the lead single Round of Blues. In what ways does working with different collaborators stretch different muscles for you as a writer?
Well, that's as varied as the amount of, you know, different people that you... write with. I remember writing Set the Prairie on Fire with Ellie, and Ellie didn't really play guitar. I mean, she did, but I, in this situation when we sat down together to write this thing, she was telling me what to play. She wasn't playing. She was like, do this, do this. And like the ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a-ding-a and I actually was able to do it. So that was cool, you know. I had to kind of invent a guitar part on the instructions from the instructions of someone else.
Right.
And with Larry, with Round of Blues, it was kind of a cool, dare I say, Lennon and McCartney thing. Because I'd written the song, and he said, it needs a bridge. And he just wrote the middle, you know, the middle eight. The middle eight, yeah.
Saying middle eight sounds very Beatle-y, too.
Well, yes, you know. I was brought up right.
You know, probably the best known song on Fat City is I Don't Know Why, which earned you a Grammy nomination for Best Female Pop Vocal. Whenever you look back on a song and you see the word Grammy next to it, it obviously takes on a different shine. Did you feel like that song was different when you wrote it?
You know, here's the story behind I Don't Know Why, and it's a pretty cool story. I mean, I say I didn't write songs till, you know, whatever, the late 80s when John and I were getting it together and I was figuring out, okay, this is who I am as a songwriter. But when I moved to New York in late 80, I didn't have a place to live. I had a job, but I didn't have a place to live. So I'm staying with different band members, trying to find an apartment. And it must have taken me 2 or 3 months before I finally did. And I stayed at Lincoln's place for a while, and he lived in the Bronx. So I'd go into Manhattan and look around for apartments, and then I'd take the D train back out to the Bronx. And, you know, I was pretty lonesome and displaced, you know, even though I had a community. And so I'm on the subway, and I wrote I Don't Know Why in my head, all the words, all the chords, and I never played it until maybe 6 months later. So...
Jeez.
Wow. Yeah, so I guess I really didn't know how to write a song.
Every time you fell away, I would lay down my life for you. I don't know why. I know these things, but I do.
It's a really simple song, and it, you know, and I, it was like a lullaby to myself. Mm. You know, it was like this comforting sort of, I mean, it, I think it's a lullaby, but it was really about comforting myself. But it's very simple, very, very simple song.
Yeah.
And I, maybe that's why I didn't think anything of it for a long time.
Yeah. Well, following the Fat City album, you released Cover Girl, a collection of songs by other writers, including Sting, Tom Waits, Willis Allen Ramsey, Steve Earle, Robbie Robertson. One of my personal favorite songs of all time is If These Walls Could Speak by Jimmy Webb, which you covered on that record. And I'm curious, at that point, why was it important for you to kind of shine the spotlight on other writers, and how did you go about even selecting the songs for that record?
Well, it was important to me because it was my tenure as a cover artist spanned a lot of years, and it supported me. It and it shaped me, and I was proud of the renditions I'd come up with, you know, of these things, and I'd done them so many times, and I learned songs and still do, you know, that I fell in love with. I mean, what? Why else would you learn a song? But,
right.
You know, it just seemed like a natural thing. Like, here, okay, I've proven myself, you know. I've made 2 records of original material. What do I do now? And I love those songs. They just mean a great deal to me, and they're a huge part of my history, I guess.
Yeah.
You know, was the thinking. And I'm just real proud. I'm real proud of how I interpreted them.
Yeah. Well, I mentioned that I saw you at 328 Performance Hall in Nashville in 96, and it was only about 9 months later that I saw you at the Ryman Auditorium with a full band. And at that point, it was right at the crest of kind of the Sonny Came Home moment, which catapulted you into a whole new realm. Sonny Came Home, of course, earned you Grammy Awards for Song of the Year and Record of the Year, and that was obviously a huge career milestone.
Sonny came home with a mission. She says days go by. I'm hypnotized. I'm walking on a wire. I close my eyes and fly out of my mind into the fire.
Were you able to enjoy that kind of whirlwind attention, or does that kind of bring a sense of pressure as a songwriter to think, okay, now I'm supposed to aim for that every time I sit down and write? I mean, what was that like for you?
I enjoyed it thoroughly. it was a complete surprise, and it was the beauty of it. The really great thing about it was that John and I, we hadn't made a record since Steady On, and we weren't as meticulous. Steady On, you'd have thought we were, we were trying to build a rocket ship to the moon, I mean, the amount of attention we gave to things that really we didn't have to, I don't know how to put it. Did we not trust ourselves? It was just a big, big deal. Like, we've been waiting so long for this moment. And I was punching syllables, in vocal takes and stuff. It was crazy. So when we got together to make what became a few small repairs, we were just really loose, and we thought we're just going to deliver the best record we can deliver. And both of us had experiences with the record companies wanting singles and things like that. And I would kind of bend the production a little bit if the record company asked, and in prior records, to serve the notion of a single. And I never had a hit, and which was okay with me, because I didn't see myself as a hit artist anyway. I was like, okay, you guys want to put a French horn on I Don't Know Why? Go ahead. they wanted I Don't Know Why was supposed to be Nothing Compares to You.
Right. Oh. Right.
That was the template for why they liked I Don't Know Why, and wanted to put it on a record or wanted to pay special attention to it. So we just went and fuck the record company in a nice way. we don't need to change anything. We know what we're doing. And there was just a great freedom in that, and we had our legs under us. We were more confident as songwriters and as recording artists, and we just had a good time. I mean, some of those songs just came about so haphazardly and breezily, and there really wasn't a lot of angst on that record at all. And the last thing we expected was for there to be a hit. So funny that even happened. So, we just thought we made a good record, and nobody questioned that. The record company didn't ask us to do anything different with anything, and so here we go, my fourth record, and just making records, yay!
Right.
And so then the Littlest Fair thing blows up, and here we go. We're on this ride with Sonny Came Home, and that was just, I was like a kid in Disneyland,
Yeah.
So the pressure didn't really descend until that was all over and it was time to make another record.
Right, right, yeah.
That's when it started to suck.
Yeah.
You know, there's been plenty of speculation over the years about the meaning of Sonny Came Home. So maybe you can tell me, is it a revenge story?
Oh, yeah.
Fun.
I mean, that's good. I don't know exactly what happened. Yeah. I really don't. Except to say she was really pissed off, you know, and somebody was going to pay.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, totally, totally, totally revenge, total revenge story. And I assume, you know, she was acquitted. Whatever.
Well, because, you know, like, I remember being a kid and, like, Phil Collins, In the Air Tonight was out. And I remember walking through my school and just, like, all these dark ideas about what the song was. And, you know, he watched one of his friends drown. And you kind of hear him interviewed about it. And he's like, nah, it's just words. So it's,
I know.
It's actually kind of nice to hear that the darkness is real in
this song. Well, the darkness is real. But it was kind of my first, one of my first forays into a song about a character.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I just made the whole thing up.
Yeah.
So, I mean, given that your first couple records were, you know, pretty personal and confessional,
right,
what do you attribute that, you know, new angle on your writing approach to start writing about characters? Why do you think that shifted at that point?
Well, in the instance of Sonny Came Home, it was pure desperation.
Hmm.
Because it was the last song to be finished. We had the track. I had the melody. I didn't have any words. And you wouldn't believe the crap that I wrote trying to to build that song and make you know, write words. And
yeah.
I had picked the album cover before Sonny Came Home was even done. That's how far into the process we were. And the album cover is a painting by my friend Julie Speed. And if you'll recall, it's a woman very much in the foreground with a lit match.
Mm-hmm.
And then very, very much in the background across this great expanse is on the horizon is what is probably a very large fire.
Hmm.
And I wrote it, I'm like, right, you know, it was almost like I had some marketing savvy for a millisecond. You know, like, just write about the woman in the painting. So that's how I did it.
It almost seems like the idea of moving into writing character-based songs could do for your lyrics what a new tuning could do for your chord structures or melodies. You know, you kind of frees you from the constraints of standard tuning, just like this frees you from the constraints of your own story.
It's true. And I think as I get older, that's more and more important because I really can't tolerate the drama, you know, of a lot of what moved me in the past. I mean, I've worked out my childhood issues pretty much. I've raised a child. I know the difference between sort of frivolous romantic drama and real life, you know, we're talking about your kid drama.
Yeah.
And do you know what I mean?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's like, yeah, so what moves me to write a song has changed.
Yeah.
And making stuff up, you know, writing about other characters, or just like the Phil Collins quote, you know, that you just mentioned, that it's just words. I find that I rely more on wordplay as well. And there's a record I made, These Four Walls, there was kind of a shift in the way that I approached writing the songs on These Four Walls because it really had a lot to do with just words coming out of my mouth that some were nonsense and then some were real and sometimes they made no sense. Like, there's a song called Cinnamon Road and All the Money in the World is Never Going to Let You Go is one of the refrains. I'm still not sure what that means, you know, but it's powerful to me.
You put them all in a box and you leave them down Cinnamon Road. All the money in the world is never gonna let you go. Oh.
you know, when you mention these four walls, the other thing about that record that was different, you know, in addition to your kind of writing approach, is the fact that that was the first record that you made after Columbia, you know, and had switched to Nonesuch. Did switching labels impact you at all in terms of did that have anything to do with freeing yourself as a writer, like, hey, fresh start, new environment, new situation, or was did that really play into it?
No, I don't think it really did. I mean, there was this gap between a few small repairs and these four walls, and in that gap came a record, you know, called A Whole New You, and that was the pressure record that, you know, I still don't know how to make sense of that record. Some of it I really like. Some of it I kind of cringe. I go, oh, you were so lost, you know. And we both had infant children, both John and I, when we were making Whole New You.
Yeah.
And so a lot of water went under the bridge between, you know, A Whole New You and these four walls. And I just kind of came back into myself. I got off Columbia because I didn't have a follow-up hit, and they didn't like that, and I think they would have kept me on, but you know, I asked to go.
Yeah.
Because I just could tell by the way I was being regarded and treated by some of the personnel that, you know, the bloom was off the rose, you know, so
right.
You know, time to move on.
I am a enormous Buddy Miller fan. He's probably one of my top 10 favorite artists of all time. So I want to talk about All Fall Down, the album you made with Buddy Miller in Nashville. And, you know, though you wrote the title track with John Leventhal, you know, this was your first album of original material in, you know, a long time where John Leventhal was not in the producer's chair. Talk about working with, you know, Buddy, working with a different producer as you're kind of bringing these songs to life in the studio in, you know, what might be maybe a little out of your comfort zone or different than what you've done before.
Well, the thing that I worried most about when I, because I'd never worked with Buddy as a producer before, he'd just been a bandmate, you know, and a friend. And he's the nicest guy in the whole world. And everyone will attest to that. And, I mean, I thought, how's this guy going to tell me whether I'm doing a good job or not? He doesn't have it in him,
yeah,
you know. Tell me to do another take. Like, I can't see it. But, you know, he does have it in him. I found out. And he's the nicest guy in the world when he tells you to do another take. Huh. But he totally had it in him. So that was my main concern, if you want to know the truth. And Buddy's so humble. You know, I just wanted Buddy Miller guitar sprayed all over the whole thing. And
right.
He was reticent to do it. And I kind of made him do that. And,
right.
But he put a great band together, Bill Frisell and Brian Blade and one of the Wood Brothers and I think Chris and who else did we have? That might have been the core.
That
was the core band.
Well, and there's also more collaborations on All Fall Down than is typical for you. You've got, you know, co-writes with Bill Frisell and Victor Krause and Kenny White. And then there's Changes on the Way with Patty Griffin. And I'm a big Patty Griffin fan, too. So I'd love to hear how that song came together.
It was pretty simple. You know, Patty says it's my song, but because she basically had that refrain, you know, I feel like a change is on the way. And I think she had the line, once you held my hand. And I don't think her original start to it was in three-quarter time either. So I just kind of took it and ran with it. But I really kind of just took what she had and was very inspired by just the little bit that I heard. She may have had more that I don't think so, though. And she gave me several ideas, and that was the one that I seized on. So we just sat in a room and kind of traded ideas for a while, and that was the one that really stuck out.
Yeah.
Well, Buddy Miller returned to the producer seat for Colvin and Earl, a duo album that you and Steve Earle released in recent years. You know, there are some covers on that record, but over half are original collaborations between you and Steve, including, you know, You're Right, I'm Wrong. Maybe I had it coming. Maybe I wanted it all. Maybe I was already out on the highway, running when I heard you call. You're right, I'm wrong, and I knew all along. We've interviewed Steve, but we've never worked with him. So what's it like to get in there and collaborate with Steve Earle?
Well, there were two aspects to it. One was the writing, the other was the recording. The writing, I was scared to death. I'm a huge Steve Earle fan, and I'm, except for John Leventhal, I'm pretty lousy at sitting in a room with someone, especially when I'm that intimidated and get, you know, and making any sense or contributing anything, you know, that I think is any good. And besides, with John Leventhal, he would give me music and, you know, often is not, and I would run off, you know, to another state, basically, and,
right.
and work on the lyrics. But with Steve, I can't tell you how pleasant it was. Steve is a very quick songwriter, very sure of himself, doesn't mince words, but isn't overly intimidating. And Steve's a handful, you know. And I was scared, but he was never condescending. He was never, oh, that's stupid. You know, because I was scared to death to give him the lyrics that I'd been coming up with. And he, yeah, that's good. We'll keep that. No, let's do this. I mean, he was like the master editor, you know, and I learned a lot writing with Steve Earle, and he would say, fear not the obvious, which was, and he's the master of that. I mean, it's he can do the most simple changes and lyrics, but they're deceptively simple, you know. Yeah. So it was really a great experience, and went fairly quickly and was kind of fun. Wow. Now the recording process was another matter because, you know, they're just more opinions to be had, you know, and more right. musicians and there's one story I've told before where we had a song completely finished. When I Close My Eyes, You're Still Gone. Okay. So, which we also wrote with Julie Miller, who had written the first verse, and then I wrote the second verse, and Steve wrote the choruses. We did it all separately. But I had lain awake the night before and had a bridge idea for this song. Well, the song was done. We were getting ready to record. I said, wait a minute. I have this idea. And he said, what is it? You know, I mean, we were ready to go into the booth and do the thing. And I said, well, I kind of had an idea for a bridge. And Steve goes, I hate bridges. I mean, this is a guy who's a big fan of the Beatles. You know, I hate bridges. I'm like, oh, really?
It's a middle eight, then. It's not a bridge.
Yeah, it's a middle eight. What do you want me to call it? The song's done. It doesn't need a bridge. I hate bridges. I'm like, it was just an idea. It was just an idea. You know, he came down hard, and I'm like, he goes, well, somebody's got to make the call. I go, I'll make the call. Let's just go in and do the song. Forget the bridge. Forget the bridge. So
like,
the next day,
you're like, Buddy's too nice to make the call. Right?
Yeah, Buddy's too nice. Well, No, I can't remember what Buddy said. He might have weighed in,
right?
But it was pretty fierce. So Steve comes in the next day. He's been working on a song called "Happy and Free," and he'd given it to me, and I'd done some some lyrical work on it. And he comes in and he's talking about it. And he goes, and here's the bridge.
You're like, I hate bridges.
I rolled my eyes. I gave him a look. It didn't even faze him. I don't think he even remembered that he had said he hated bridges.
That's amazing.
I'm like, okay. I see how you are.
That's great. Well, you have certainly created an impressive body of work. And I want to close with a question that is maybe nearly impossible to answer. But if you had to take just one of your original songs and put it in a time capsule to be unlocked in 1,000 years, what is the one song that you would want to represent Sean Colvin, the songwriter?
And people let you get by with this?
We'll see.
You get away. People give you an answer. Do they answer this?
Sometimes yes. Sometimes they can't. They narrow it down to maybe like five.
I can't remember if we asked Steve this question or not.
We would not have asked Steve this question. No.
Did you not ask him that question?
No, we did not ask him that question.
Oh my god.
We said if you had one bridge.
Yeah. That you could get rid of.
Yeah.
What's your most hated bridge?
It's that one that Sean brought in.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, listen, nobody ever
heard it.
An ear. No. I've blocked it out. It's traumatic for me. Okay, Time Capsule, one of my songs. Jeez. I think it would either be Diamond in the Rough or Polaroids. So how do I choose? I just think Diamond in the Rough is a really strong song, and I think it's kind of redemptive, and I love Polaroids. I think it's a really good, I don't know.
Well, Scott, can we let her put a cassette in and have one on each side? Can we do that?
She could record an acoustic medley of Diamond in the Rough and Polaroids.
Fair enough.
I could do that.
I'll just do that.
Yeah, you didn't say what the format was.
Right.
You got a jump drive? What's in
this?
Yeah.
It's going to be on ADAT, I think.
Yeah, exactly. Well, those are two absolutely fantastic songs, two of my favorites. Sean, we've both been fans for years, so it's an honor for us to chat with you about your career, and thank you for sharing some time with us today.
Well, I appreciate your interest. It's flattering, and I had a good time. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. We'd love to stay connected with you, so please take a moment now to subscribe to Songcraft in your podcast app of choice and sign up for our email list at songcraftshow.com.
As a reminder, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram by searching for Songcraft Show, all one word. And don't forget to check out our Patreon page at patreon.com/songcraftshow to find out how you can help support us. That's patreon.com/songcraftshow.
Thanks, as always, for listening and for your support.
Sunny came home to her favorite room. Sunny sat down.